One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright.
A little more than a decade ago, an article crossed my desktop. On January 25, 1999, the Chicago Tribune published an article about a mysterious object found at the bottom of Lake Michigan. Quote, "If one set out with the preposterous goal of making an oak zeppelin 31 feet long, 10 feet in diameter, pointed at its ends, complete with an 18-inch hatch to crawl inside, this is pretty much what you'd get. Those who have strapped on air tanks and visited the thing say the craftsmanship used to build it is remarkable. 4-inch-thick oak boards bent and fitted together and caulked watertight like nothing built today." End quote. Of course, many LDS readers were quick to identify the object as a Jaredite barge, and messages were circulated widely around the internet, proof of the Book of Mormon. Today, we're going to be talking about Mormon urban and or historical legends, perhaps even some real stories that get a little bit twisted. And joining me today are Jeffrey Cannon, Michael Landon, Janice Johnson, and Emily Utt, alphabetical order. And I appreciate all of you being here. And we're just going to talk about some stories that seem to crop up in the church, whether they're true or not. So let's start off with who has a favorite that they'd like to begin with today.
Well, I wonder actually if we want to take a step back, because this could become all of our jobs full time if we wanted it to. Debunking Mormon myths, or, you know, every week in Sunday school, you'll hear a story, and then suddenly your friends call you and say, is this true? And this could become our jobs if we let it. But I think an understanding of what these myths are and how we go about debunking them and thinking about them will really help people to perhaps stop sharing them without good sourcing. I think one of the things we love about Mormon myths is that they teach us something that we want to be true. We want to believe that God protects his people. We want to believe that if you sacrifice, you will be blessed. We want to believe that everything in the Book of Mormon can be verified. And the real challenge happens is that those things are not always true, that sometimes you sacrifice and you don't get a blessing. So we will go back into history and find a story and embellish it just a little bit, so we can keep believing some things. And the fun part of it then is to go back and try to trace through the story and think about it logically and say, do all of these pieces match up?
And blessings are things that are very difficult to try and quantify. But sometimes we try to quantify. This is the best or the longest or the greatest. Another recent myth that has gone around was this email, and with email, the advent of email, we get things that are circulated, have so much more mileage than they ever would have had before. But after 9/11, there were emails that went around saying that there was supposed to be a missionary zone conference in the World Trade Center on 9/11. And there are different versions of the story, but something happened, so none of the missionaries showed up. Whether none of their alarms went off, none of them woke up, none of them made it there. For people who were in New York at the time, I have a good friend of mine who was there. This was really distressing to her to hear this. There's no truth to it. But sometimes we feel those goosebumps and we want something to be true. But if we look at it logically and kind of try to take it apart a little, zone meetings are held in churches. Zone meetings are held in easy places for the missionaries to come together.
Which are free.
Which are free. And free is a very important consideration there. And that the World Trade Center, that's just not possible. But I think this idea stems from, again, what Emily was saying, the idea that if we are righteous, we'll be protected. And I do believe that ultimately we will be protected. Our souls will not be destroyed if we are righteous. But bad things happen to good people all the time. And I think some stories like that can be really destructive. There were good people who lost their lives that day who weren't protected. And that becomes difficult for those who are very closely involved. Whereas who knows why people create stories like this, but it can have disastrous effects.
The World Trade Center story is actually a good one to go through the process that historians use to debunk myths to find out the truth of them. For example, so the first thing we think about is, where do missionaries hold zone conference? They hold them in a meeting house. So there's no logical reason for them to be held at the World Trade Center. And then what are the odds of every single missionary sleeping through their alarm or missing the train that day? You might have one companionship who's late, but all of them is probably not likely. And then you go back and you try to find the earliest source. So in this case, you could call the mission president and say, was there a zone conference on that day?
No, there was no zone conference
that day. So that's what we try to do with history. We try to think about it logically. Does it make sense with what we know and understand about the world? And then you go back and try to find the first time the story is told and who told it and why they told it. And so a lot of my favorite stories fall apart because you go back and try to find a source and there is no source.
People want, you know, they hear these type of stories and they so want them to be true because they're so fantastic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that may somehow confirm something to them,
it's
their faith or whatever.
Process.
Exactly.
I mean, they're so exceptional, and in a sense, it's a validation for a lot of people. I think that's why some of them are couched in superlative terms. Like the longest march in history was the March of the Mormon Battalion.
And everybody knows that.
That's, well, at least
that's what,
understood.
That's why we're here today.
That's right. And I think that got started because the commander of the Mormon Battalion, Philip St. George Cook, said that history may be searched in vain for an equal march of infantry, something to that effect. And people, well, gee, that it had to be. You can search history, you're never going to find an infantry march like the Mormon Battalion. So it's just a small leap to say, well, it must have been the longest one. When you look, again, as Emily's pointed out, you look at, you know, the facts, the Chinese communists under Mao marched 6,000 miles to the Yangtze in the Long March. Alexander the Great, somewhere between 22 to 25,000 miles were logged by his infantry. And people say, well, there was, you know, periods when they weren't marching, but at least one period, there was a forced march of over 2,000 miles. And even in 1858, during the Utah War, there were some units who went from Leavenworth to Bridger. The Utah War situation was solved. They sent them on to California and back, an infantry march which would far exceed anything that the battalion would have made. And I think the issue is, rather than concentrating on the absolutes, was it the most, the best, the longest, the first? It's the other issues that should be considered about what was the Mormon Battalion experience like for an individual soldier? What kind of sacrifices did he make? The issue of longest really doesn't generate much for me. But if somebody tells me about a sacrifice that an individual battalion member made during that long march, that has more meaning to me. And those kinds of things, the experiences he had in his march, can be documented. And there's a factual foundation for it. So I think there's value in that kind of analysis.
And sometimes I think it's that emotional reaction that maybe longest or that's some sort of superlative makes us, our ears perk up and we think, oh, this is great. We have this emotional reaction. But ultimately, history is much more complicated and complex, and there's a lot more to it. And in most instances, I think the real story is so much better. Not most instances. It's always better It may be much more complicated and it may not fit into nice, neat little boxes, but it tells us things about what mortality is about. One of the persistent myths is regarding the persecutors of Joseph Smith.
There was a book, actually.
There was a book, actually, that was written, and the author made a collection. People had family stories of horrible things that happened to everyone, but principally the people who were in the trial of Joseph's after Joseph's murder. And this book tells these horrific, I mean, I have all sorts of images of skin falling off and eyes rolling around. But they're really kind of horrific stories of things that happened to these people. And Elder Oaks and Marvin Hill, before Elder Oaks was an elder, wrote a book called Carthage Conspiracy, focused on the trial of the accused assassins of Joseph and Hiram Smith. And in the afterword, they go through very methodically what happened to all of the people who were involved, the accused, the defense attorneys, the prosecuting attorneys, the judge, Governor Ford, and most of them lived very successful lives. I don't know where these stories came from, but I do know that we have this desire we want bad things to happen to bad people. And often that doesn't acknowledge that there's any sort of badness in any of us. But we want to see people pay for their sins. And here is an instance where it just didn't play out that way. In mortality. I am not the one judging them ultimately, and that is left for God to decide. But in mortality, they lived very successful lives. Governor Ford perhaps did not turn out as well as some of the rest. The judge also ended up in being committed. So that was not a great one. But Ford, and this is Ford, I think, is quite prophetic. It's fascinating. He writes a history of Illinois. He's very sick later in his life, and trying to provide funds for his family, he writes this history of Illinois. And he laments. He says, "It is the possibility that the names of Nauvoo and Carthage Jail may become holy and venerable names, places of classic interest in another age, like Jerusalem, the Garden of Gethsemane, and the Mount of Olives, and Mount Calvary to the Christian." Ford wrote, "If this were to be the case, he felt degraded by the reflection that the humble governor of an obscure state who would otherwise be forgotten in a few years stands a fair chance, like Pilate and Herod, by their official connection with the true religion, of being dragged down to posterity with an immortal name hitched on the memory of a miserable imposter." So, to be sure that is clear, he is not saying that Joseph was an equivalent of Christ or someone who should be venerated, but that he was a miserable imposter. And it was horrible for him to think of the fact that where he died might be a venerated place, which Carthage has certainly become today, that Nauvoo has certainly become today, and that people would look on him as a pilot. Washing his hands of his connection with Christ, and but I think that he was a little prophetic there. That connection is still there, but for the majority of those people who were involved in Joseph's death directly, they lived happy, successful lives. For many of them, it helped their careers.
You know, Janice brings up an interesting point here when she's talking about places that are venerated. No place in Mormon culture is more venerated than the temple, of course. And we've discussed amongst ourselves some of these myths that happen about the temple, and we've wondered why this is. And of course, the temple is a sacred and holy place, and so it stands to reason that sacred and holy things should happen there, and there should be these great miracles. When people expect that, people find that. And one of the most common myths that I've heard, and I've heard this in multiple wards in multiple continents, is a story about the Salt Lake Temple. And the story goes that when the temple was being designed, Brigham Young insisted that there be these mysterious shafts built in the temple, and nobody knew what they were for. And then many years later, temple engineers, when they were getting ready to install elevators, found that these were the perfect size and in the perfect orientation to be elevator shafts. And so they installed these elevators. And the story is told as a sort of proof of the revelation of Brigham Young and the specialness of the temple. Well, there's a problem with the story. And one of the problems is that the elevator is in the plans to the Salt Lake Temple. And that in the 1887 plans, and of course, the temple takes 40 years to build, and the interior isn't built or isn't even designed until after the death of Brigham Young. The 1887 plans are the first plans we see where there's even a shaft that could be considered an elevator shaft, and it's very clearly labeled elevator. The elevator company that's installed it was the Otis Brothers and Company organization, and they were founded in 1853, the same year that the temple was begun construction, when Elisha Otis sold his first elevator. And we actually have in the archives a proposal to build two elevators for the temple, which is there for anyone to see. And we've actually published it in an online collection that people can view, and then they can see that there was an elevator in the original temple, and that maybe this isn't a great story of Brigham Young's inspiration, but I think it is a story of inspiration. And it's much more this idea of studying it out in your minds. The temple in Salt Lake was not the first temple to be built. It was certainly not the first temple to be built in the history of the church, but it wasn't even the first temple to be built in Utah. And although it was begun first, it was finished last of the pioneer temples. And it's sort of the successor in some ways to those other temples as they were built, and they understood the process of the endowment and how the endowment and other temple ordinances are administered. They realized as they built them, and they built a better plan and a better plan with each temple. And so by the end, they had a very good plan that has had very little alteration to the temple in the over 100 years that it's been in use. And I think that's sort of a demonstration not of this fantastic revelation from Brigham Young, but more this idea of studying it out in your minds, this idea of doctrine, this doctrine of revelation that we're all very familiar with, of studying it out in your mind, and the Lord will tell you it is correct. And I think that that is sort of a demonstration of the story, the true story really does demonstrate more the ideas of doctrine that we're all familiar with than this fantastic idea that prophets have revelations of elevator shafts before the elevator is even invented.
Thanks, Jeffrey. We are on Legacy here on the Mormon Channel. We're talking about Mormon urban and historical legends with four members of the historical department, Jeffrey Cannon, Michael Landon, Janice Johnson, and Emily Utt. And there's some stories that I'm afraid may disappoint some listeners today. of course, the elevator shaft story we just heard was true doctrine until just now, because I guess the biggest surprise is, yes, they had elevators in the 1800s. So I have a few quotes here from President Harold B. Lee in a talk that he gave in 1973, and I just want to read a couple of these portions of this talk. He said, "There is one thing that shocks me. I have learned in some instances that those who have heard of these rumors are disappointed when they tell them they are not so. They seem to have enjoyed believing a rumor without substance of fact. I would earnestly urge that no such idle gossip be spread abroad without making certain as to whether or not it is true." So does that apply to emails too? Or?
Oh, it certainly applies to emails. And one of the emails I think that a lot of people have had, and one of the really difficult things to do with a myth is to get it stopped. And as we mentioned there are people who really want these things to be true. There is a quote that gets circulated a lot, email and otherwise, that's often attributed, most frequently attributed to President Packer of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, but is also attributed to other people. And the story is something along the lines of the youth of today were generals in the war in heaven, and that when they die, they will be speaking with the others whom they meet in the spirit world, and they will be discussing the dispensations and time periods in which they live. And some will say, I lived in the time period of Joseph Smith, and people will be impressed. And others will say, I lived in the time period of Brigham Young, and people will be impressed. But the youth of today will say, I lived in the time period of Gordon B. Hinckley, and all in the hall will hush and bow in their presence. Well, President Packer heard this rumor that he had said this, and in 2001 released a statement saying, quote, I did not make that statement. I do not believe that statement, end quote. And this was put in the church news, widely disseminated church news. But it didn't end there. 7 years later, just after the death of President Hinckley, of course a quote like this is going to gain some currency in a time like that where President Hinckley has just died. But 7 years later, we have an official statement from the First Presidency, which in bold type says this is a false statement. It is not church doctrine. So you see the difficulty in quashing some of these myths because people want to believe them. They want them to be true. But we have the greatest story in the world. There's no reason to make anything up.
Wanting to be part of such an amazing quote, an amazing concept, I think is probably part of the reason why they just keep getting generated, even though it's totally false. Let's go back to the Mormon Battalion for a minute. Of course, they were there and probably was the first person to find that big nugget of gold.
Well, actually,
at the gold rush, wasn't he? He was in the Mormon Battalion, made the march, and he was right there.
That's right. In fact, you know, who knows what the economic development of the United States would have been if the Mormon Battalion hadn't found that nugget of gold.
Okay. We better stop there and tell people exactly what happened.
Well, there were a lot of people working on a construction project at Coloma on the American River. It was a mill that John Sutter wanted to a lumber mill he wanted constructed, and his partner, James Marshall, took some former Mormon Battalion members. They were veterans at this time. They'd been discharged the previous July. Took them up to the Sierra foothills on this construction project. And in the tail race one day, Marshall found what appeared to be gold and showed it to the other battalion members. Fortunately, one of them, Henry Bigler, recorded in his diary that today some metal was found in the tail race, which appears to be gold, or looks like gold. Marshall goes down to Sacramento. Sutter tests it and finds that it's pure gold. And Marshall comes back up and tells the battalion members. Well, there was also another family that was working, involved in the construction, the Wimmer family. The tradition in their family is that it was their children that found the gold in the tail race. There are some scholars who believe that actually it was Native Americans who brought the gold to Marshall and showed him. And of course, many of the descendants of those individuals, individual battalion members who were there, would like to believe that their ancestor was responsible for such a momentous event that changed the course of American history. But it's the documentary record, Bigler's in particular, that really sets the record straight. For a long time, they didn't even know what day it was discovered. But John Hittell, a historian, in the late 1800s, began writing the battalion members, asking them for the story. And he found out that Bigler had actually recorded the date. Bigler tore the page out of his journal and mailed it to Hittell. And that page actually is in the holdings of the Society of California Pioneers in San Francisco. Later, at the time, he said that this gold was found, gives the date, 24 January. And later, he wrote in above it that it was found by James Marshall, M-A-R-T-I-A-L, instead of M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L, the boss of the mill. So here's Bigler stating categorically who it was who found the gold. But I've had many discussions with individuals who said, no, that's inaccurate. The battalion discovered the gold and gave it to James Marshall. Even after I've related to them the evidence from both Henry Bigler as well as Azariah Smith that Marshall was the discoverer, it just didn't seem to register that. And my point is, does it really matter? I mean, in a sense, it was a momentous event, but the actual discoverer, we know it was discovered. Sometimes the problem is there was two other Mormon battalion veterans who discovered gold at another location, which later became known as Mormon Island. And many people thought that because of this great strike that these two battalion vets found after the discovery of gold at Coloma, that in fact it was the Mormon battalion that discovered gold. They were definitely involved in it. And Henry Bigler, once it was proved to be gold, spent a lot of his spare time hunting for it. He even says, of all of them, he had the worst case of gold fever. But it's pretty conclusive that James Marshall picked it out and told the battalion members that he had. In fact, when he came back, he says, boys, I'm rich. I found a gold mine.
Again, I think it's this desire to be part of something bigger than who we are or what we are. And so no matter what you say, Michael, I'm pretty sure my great-grandfather in the Moore Battalion found gold there. So so let's move on to let's go back to Carthage for just a minute. We all know for fact that a bullet hit John Taylor. It struck his watch, and that's what saved his life. Everybody knows that for sure.
And the problem with that myth is that John Taylor himself started it. And that's a really tough one to deal with. And so the research on this one has actually been pretty recent, that a few people who have expertise in forensics were looking at John Taylor's pocket watch, which is on exhibit at the Church History Museum. You can go anytime and see it. And were comparing it to some of the damage done to Hiram Smith's watch and noticing that they don't work. There's no way that both of those watches could have been hit by a bullet. So they did a little bit more research on it and found that they even found other period pocket watches and started firing bullets at them to see if they could replicate the damage to John Taylor's watch, and they couldn't. So they took a closer look at the watch and discovered that it appears, and again, we can't know this for certain, that as John Taylor was falling, he fell into the windowsill, and the force of that fall pushed some of the workings of the watch through the face, leaving a small hole in the face of the watch, and then creased the back of the watch. And somewhere in that effort, then John Taylor then fell under the bed and survived the attack. And the challenge that we have with that one is that John Taylor felt that his life was miraculously saved, which it was. By all accounts, he should have died from his injuries. There's no reason for him to have lived. And so as he was healing, he asked for his clothes to be brought to him and saw the damage to the watch, saw a hole in his pocket where the watch had been, and assumed that the watch had been hit by a bullet. But in reality, the story is much more powerful. God doesn't need a watch to save someone's life. He needed to preserve John Taylor's life for a bigger purpose. He needed him to be witness of the martyrdom. He needed him to be a president of the church. And so he saved his life. The pocket watch is a good artifact to document the event. It is a good artifact to document the time that it happened, because as he fell against the window, the watch stopped. So it is a powerful witness of the martyrdom, but the watch itself didn't save John Taylor.
And the watch, I think, is perhaps a positive anecdote about what we want to believe. We have some others that come to us because they're negative, and people want to believe negative things. There is a persistent historical rumor about Emma pushing Eliza R. Snow down the stairs in Nauvoo, that Emma, angry about polygamy, pushed Eliza R. Snow down the stairs. This is an instance that most of these ideas come from a time when the church in general, or some of the leaders of the church, were very upset with Emma for not coming to Utah. And you have
a variety of different stories, but the initial account actually comes from an anti-Mormon polemic novel that was written in 1886 and talks about two separate things. Talks about Eliza Partridge being pushed by Emma down the stairs, and talks about Eliza Arsenault actually being attacked by Emma with a broomstick. And we have some sort of conflation of these stories that comes together and creates this idea, creates this antagonism. The idea that Emma was antagonistic towards plural marriage, there is truth in that. There is definitely truth in that. Yet Eliza Arsenault, when after Emma's death and her son, Joseph Smith III, comes and gives Emma's last testimony in which she denounces polygamy and says – it completely says that Joseph never practiced it, that was never part of the church that Joseph established. And Eliza's response is Emma would never say such a thing, that did not come from Emma. And I think that some people have built up that antagonism, and this little incident, this anecdote, exemplifies that idea of this antagonism. Eliza was the faithful polygamous wife and Emma was the evil one. And a lot of these stories also get play because they follow a very simple fictional narrative. You have good and you have evil and they attack one another and one of them triumphs. And it's kind of this basic fictional formulaic that people use to tell a story. But when you try and pin it down historically, it doesn't hold up.
Thank you, Janice. As a reminder, you're listening to Legacy on the Mormon Channel. We're talking about Mormon myths today. One of the great stories of sacrifice in church history is the building of the Kirtland Temple, and how at one point the sisters wanting to be part of the sacrifice and making the temple as beautiful as possible took their china, their good china, and ground it up and put it on the walls to make the temple shine. And, of course, it's a heartwarming story, but I'm just wondering about the veracity of this.
That is one of those stories where we can't find any sources for it. There's no account that that women gave their fine china to the temple. However, we do have a source that talks about where the bits of china that are in the walls came from, because anyone who visits the Kirtland Temple can see original pieces of the stucco and sees that there are pieces of china there. Artemis Millett, who is one of the stonemasons on the temple, wrote this: "When the wall of the temple was finished, Artemis sent men and boys to the different towns and places to gather old crockery and glass to put in the cement which A. Millett had invented." So basically, Artemis Millett sent people out and asked everyone to go through their trash heaps and find all of the pieces of glass and crockery that had broken. If anyone who's visited historic sites knows, crockery, old dishes and things break rather easily, especially the common everyday things. And so you would find this just in your trash heap. And so they sent boys out with pails and asked people to donate their broken china to the temple. So I think that's really a great story, because it's not that they donated their finest, it's that they took something that they thought was no longer usable and reworked it into something that added to the beauty of the temple.
Any other temple myths anybody wants to debunk today?
Oh, there's a great one. There's a great one involving the Hawaii temple, the first Hawaii temple in Laie. The story goes like this, that on the day of Pearl Harbor, that there was one or several Japanese bomber pilots who were assigned to bomb the Hawaii temple. And there are actually several different versions of this, but this is my favorite one. This is probably the most fantastic version. That he was assigned to bomb the Hawaii temple, and when he got over the temple, he pressed the button to drop the bomb, and the bomb wouldn't drop. And he tried this several times, and it wouldn't drop. And then over the years afterward, he was intrigued by this fact. And when he finally found out what the building was, whether missionaries approached him and taught him the gospel beforehand or found out from some other means, depends on which version of the story you hear. But when he found out, he was so impressed by this fact and that he joined the church and that he later became a general authority. Now, there are two potential general authorities that are part of this story, and one of them is Elder Adney Y. Komatsu, who was a member of the First Quorum of the 70 between 1976 and 1993. Now, Elder Komatsu was raised in Hawaii and served in the American Army during World War II.
Okay, all right. So,
the other possible general authority is Elder Kikuchi, Yoshihiko Kikuchi, who is currently serving in the First Quorum of the 70. The problem with that is that Elder Kikuchi was 5 months old.
They start them young over there, from what I hear.
So there's a little bit of a problem with those two candidates for having been the person who supposedly dropped the bomb. Kenneth Baldridge of BYU Hawaii has actually researched this story quite extensively, and he can find no version of it before the 1960s. So it's one of those stories that's a great story, but it's come about a little bit later, and we can't really verify that it's happened. But we also really can't verify that it didn't happen, but I'm pretty sure that Elder Komatsu and Elder Kikuchi are innocent.
Another temple story is kind of similar that we can trace back to where it started, and we can see perhaps, you know, where it started. The St. George Temple Tower, there's a story goes that Brigham Young was in St. George and the temple was about finished. He looked up at the tower and said, "That tower is too short and squatty, change it." And the residents of St. George said, "We're not going to change it. The temple is too close to being finished." And then Brigham Young dies shortly after the temple is dedicated. And within a very short amount of time, the tower is hit by lightning and burned to the base. And the story goes that Brigham got his way finally. It's a wonderful story. This story originates in 1977, is the problem. There is a member of who used to be a member of the church history staff who he recalls that he was in St. George and gave a fireside of some kind and told that story as a joke, and then it got printed in the newspaper the next day. And the story has just continued from there. However, there is some element of truth to what happened. We have one account, one source of Brigham Young saying, "I don't like that tower." And he had this conversation with his son, Brigham Young Jr. in St. George. It was a private conversation, and Brigham Young Jr. wrote this in his journal. He said that the tower is wooden and a very unsatisfactory piece of work. Father remarked he would keep the tower locked, that he was ashamed of the framing and design. It is some 12 to 18 feet too low to look well. President says they will have that remedied some these days. How mechanics can do such work and call it right is a mystery to me. So this was a conversation between two carpenters. I don't like the tower. The problem is, in public, after they give this, both Brigham Young Jr. and President Brigham Young say how beautiful the temple is and how pleased they are with the work. So if Brigham Young had said that to someone, it would have been changed. The people of St. George in the 19th century were known for being some of the most faithful Latter-day Saints. If Brigham Young said, "Change the tower," they would have done it. This was a people, they said, when they wanted to change the location of the temple construction because the ground was too marshy. But Brigham Young said, "Build the temple there." So they kept building. So why would they, in case of temple construction, follow Brigham Young, but when the temple's finished, not? It just doesn't make any sense. However, about 18 months after Brigham Young dies, the temple was hit by lightning, but they weren't aware of how much damage had been done until they went up in 1883 to fix the roof, and someone's boot went through the roof. And then they realized just how much damage had been done and decided now was the time to change the tower. So Brigham Young may have disliked it, but he really didn't call lightning down. And what's interesting is that you read the quotes from Wilford Woodruff and other church leaders about the temple getting hit by lightning, and their comments are that the hand of God has protected this building from more serious damage. They saw minor damage and saw that God had protected them. So it's a very different version.
Which, once again, is a much better story.
Yes. So.
This idea of prophets and prophets' words are sometimes is sometimes a difficult thing, especially when we get to Joseph Smith. And Joseph he writes down his revelations, or other people, scribes write down his revelations. Joseph himself doesn't write things down very often. And so we have a record that comes from through other people. Some things get more play than others. The White Horse Prophecy is a purported prophecy that has gotten a lot of mileage over the years, through the years.
In this, there are different versions of the prophecy, but there is a white horse, which is the church, pale horse, which is the U.S., a red horse and a black horse, which some interpreted as Indians or African Americans. But basically, the white horse saves everything. The country is in ruin. The banks have all failed. Gold isn't of any use anymore. The Constitution is hanging by a thread. And the white horse comes in and saves everything. This was purportedly given in 1843 by two people who it's very difficult to actually connect them historically to the stories of this. But in 1918, Joseph Fielding Smith, in General Conference, he says, he's talking about the white horse prophecy, and he says, "I have discovered that people have copies of this a purported vision by the prophet Joseph Smith given in Nauvoo, and some people are circulating this supposed vision or revelation or conversation which the prophet is reported to have held with a number of individuals in the city of Nauvoo. I want to say to you, my brethren and sisters, that if you understand the church articles and covenants, if you will read the scriptures and become familiar with those things which are recorded in the revelations from the Lord, it will not be necessary for you to ask any questions in regard to the authenticity or otherwise of any purported revelation, vision, or manifestation that proceeds out of darkness, concocted in some corner, surreptitiously presented, and not coming through the proper channels of the church." His father, Joseph F. Smith, who is prophet at the time, gets up after him and says that ridiculous story about the red horse and the black horse and the white horse and a lot of trash that has been circulated about and printed and sent as a great revelation given by the prophet Joseph Smith, it is simply false. That is all there is to it. I think in this instance, we have authorities refuting this, but yet it is something that still gets a lot of airtime. But I think that the Joseph Fielding Smith quote is very important because it sets out a way for us to analyze these things. The Lord tells us in the Doctrine and Covenants that we receive revelation in our minds and in our hearts. A lot of these things we have an emotional reaction to, and we want them to be true. But the Lord also tells us to not ignore our minds and not ignore our faculties of reason that he has given us. And here Joseph Fielding Smith, as an apostle, is saying, read the scriptures, know what's in the scriptures. If you know the articles and covenants, if you read the scriptures, those things that are recorded in the revelations from the Lord, you're not going to be fooled by one of these things. And I think that setting that up is really important. If we have a basis, if our foundation is in faith, repentance, and baptism, if it is in the foundational principles of the gospel, then even if we heard something we really believed it was true and we later find out it's not, we're going to be okay. We can't base our testimony in those things. Our testimony needs to be based in true doctrine and faith, repentance, and baptism. Those are that's the beginning, and that is the foundation.
Good. Thank you. I would like to refer back to the President Lee talk. He quoted a First Presidency 1913 warning to members of the church in his talk, and I would just like to read that quick little paragraph. "All faithful members are entitled to inspiration of the Holy Spirit for themselves, their families, and for those over whom they are appointed and ordained to preside. But anything at discord with that which comes from God through the head of the church is not to be received as authoritative or reliable. In secular as well as spiritual affairs, saints may receive divine guidance and revelation affecting themselves, but this does not convey authority to direct others and is not to be accepted when contrary to church covenants, doctrine or discipline, or to known facts, demonstrated truths, or good common sense." I thought that was such an amazing statement from 1913, and, you know, it still holds so true in our day of electronic rumor. So
let me give you a good common sense example of some of this. I've heard four buildings with this same general story. Every time I turn around, I seem to find another one, that pioneers were building their meeting house and they had the walls up, and then they realized they didn't know what to do next. So they stand around scratching their heads, and then they remember that Brother Jones down the street is a shipbuilder who had joined the church in Scotland or Denmark or fill in your country here. And so they bring him over, and he says, oh, well, I don't know how to build a roof, but I know how to build a ship. So build your meeting house like a ship, and we'll work it out. I can think of at least four buildings with this story. There are several problems with these stories. First off, I'm surprised that there were that many shipbuilders in Pioneer, Utah, and that few carpenters, that they could build the buildings and then suddenly lose all professional skill.
They could build their houses, yet didn't know how to build a little bit bigger church building.
And there are several things available to them. First off, people have been building vaulted ceilings, arch ceilings, since Roman times. Barrel vaults are, you know, it's a major feature of Roman architecture. And every Gothic cathedral has an arch in it. So there are lots of examples of how to build arches and vaults and big, beautiful ceilings that you don't have to be a shipbuilder to do. Now, you may be able to use some of your shipbuilding skills, you know, knowing how to work with large pieces of timber to do this, but you don't need to be a shipbuilder to build a roof. The other thing that happens is that there were design books, very common design books in the 19th century that anyone could have access to. So if you didn't know how to build, you could buy one of these books. It's kind of like the historical equivalent of going down to your local hardware store and asking a guy how to do it.
A how-to.
It's a how-to book. And you could learn how to build very complicated, very large buildings from these design books. And what else is interesting about Mormon towns is that for many of these communities, a good portion of your community knew how to work with wood. I've heard numbers anywhere from 15 to 30% of people in these towns were carpenters who knew how to work with wood, who knew how to build large buildings. And so needing to build it like a ship is not necessary because you have men in the towns who already know how to build. So I can so I find these stories most common when I go on tours of historic sites, of historic meeting houses. I hear the most from people who have never really looked at the roof, who they heard it from somebody else and they've repeated it. But if they actually look up at the roof and think about it for a couple of minutes, it doesn't make sense. It's far too complicated to have a shipbuilder come in and build your roof when you know how to do it yourself because you just finished your house and it has the same theme.
When you have a bridge builder, like with the case of the tabernacle, you don't need a shipbuilder.
So. Exactly.
Any other – we're getting close on time here. Any other rumors that we need to dispel today?
I think one last favorite is that everyone who came to Utah came by handcart. That's a common one we hear, and the handcarts are becoming the great symbol of the trek.
Right, and that's not so much a myth as it is sort of a perception that the handcart has become the symbol of the trek, and that every pioneer
during the sesquicentennial, the symbol was a handcart.
Which is really quite funny because the handcarts didn't happen for another 10 years. Which the hand carts and the early pioneers are separated by quite a few years, a decade at least. And that, you know, one of the perceptions that a lot of people have, we have a lot of stakes and wars that take their youth out on these handcart treks, which are wonderful experiences for these young people. And a lot of them have someone dressed up in a Mormon battalion uniform, and they come and they recruit all of the young men to go off in the Mormon battalion. And then this is usually on the day of the hardest part of the pull. And then they have what's called the women's pull. And this happens all over the church, I think. And then all of these young men have to stand there and watch as these young women pull up these handcarts. And it's this very emotional event for these people. And if you talk to these people, they will tell you, oh, this was the greatest part of it. Well, the problem is there's no recruitment of the Mormon battalion of the handcart pioneers. And there's this emotional response. The spirit cannot testify of a lie. It's very important that we get these things right because the spirit will not testify of something that's not true. And I don't doubt that these people have wonderful experiences, and I don't doubt that people have very emotional attachments to things, and I don't doubt that people have a witness from the Holy Ghost. But it's very important that we separate the two.
The Mormon Battalion came in 1846. Well, the handcart started in 1856.
Even more than that. I think even if they were making a composite,
and
they're trying to make representational experience, that they would have a disclaimer. You need to understand, those of you who are involved in this, that there's a decade difference between the recruitment of the battalion and the departure of the first handcart company. There is no connection historically, an entire decade between those two events. But what we're trying to give you is a composite experience. And so they take these, they try to take an overview of the Overland experience and mesh in, sort of blend in some of these experiences. And that's how you get this sort of mixing of the 1856 handcart experience with, well, 1856 to 1860, with an 1846 Mormon Battalion trek. It's a, I mean, as a device, it may have some utility as long as the participants understand. Take a look at your history and you'll know the two events can't be connected historically.
So as a composite event, perhaps to give an overview of what most or all or some of the pioneers went through, as long as they know the facts,
right,
it's probably okay.
I would think that if they want to understand the overall experience, maybe they could craft it a little bit differently so that they would understand that there is no possibility that these two events, which are totally disconnected, have a connection. I mean, that will be the impression that some may walk away with, is that, hey, the Mormon Battalion is the same year as the handcarts. The other issue is that everybody, really, from 1846 until a railroad came, pulled a handcart. There may have been a wagon here and a wagon there. But I mean, along with some church members, they have this idea that people came, almost the vast majority of church members came by handcart, when it was just a fraction of the total. And even in wagon trains, people walked most of the time.
A wagon is not comfortable. No one wants to
ride. Even then, you're trying to shepherd your stock. There's lots of reasons not to have people in the wagon. You have drovers walk alongside with their whips.
And we know that all pioneer children sang as they walked. So
yes.
Now, to put a little plug in, that anyone who is really interested in knowing more about the truth behind these stories, almost all of the sources that we've been quoting are available at the Church History Library. And that if you want to better prepare your youth for a pioneer trek, come to the Church History Library, come to the Church History Museum. There are people there that can help explain some of the truth of these stories, and the, or can help you do research yourself so you can find the truth behind these stories.
Or if you have a myth that you really want to know the truth of and you can't seem to research and get to it yourself, we like answering those questions.
More so than the coworker who probably has a pretty good idea, right? Send it off to Bill. He probably knows exactly what's going on. Okay. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking today with Jeffrey Cannon, Michael Landon, Janice Johnson, and Emily Utt from the Historical Department. We've been talking about Mormon myths and trying to debunk a few of the things that have gone on for years. Thank you, one and all, for being here. This has been really fun.
Thank you.